Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Morrow, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm really excited today. Happy New Year, everybody. It's a new year, 2016.
Happy New Year.
And I'm very happy. I'm very pleased and honored to have Don Randy tonight as our guest.
Thank you.
Also, I got Monique's back in town.
Yay.
She's with her daughter, Carmen. And it's great to have you back in L.A. But Don, it's really an honor. Don has been on. He was on a couple of times with me with when we had Denny Tedesco on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast. He's a member of the Wrecking Crew. Now, I know this is a guitar show, and Don's a keyboardist, but it's a very – I think we're going to have a very interesting show and some stuff that I think is really important to hear. Don has played on pretty much everything that's influenced me in my career, especially in the 60s. Every hit you've heard, whether it's the Beach Boys or whether it was the Monkees or whether it was the Righteous Brothers, any of the Phil Spector stuff, he played on all that stuff. And he played on a lot more. He actually did soundtracks. He composed for soundtracks, and we'll try to dig into a little bit of that. But he wrote a book. He just came out with a book in August called You've Heard These Hands. And I picked it up as soon as it was available and read this thing, and it's a great
Thank you very much.
It's just some great stories in here. And we're going to go into that a little bit. But first, what I wanted to say was I wanted to ask you, start out with this question is, you talk about in the book about all these sessions, and this, you know, in the 60s, it was pretty busy. You guys were just constantly going and playing and all these different things. But then again, you were touring with Nancy Sinatra, and you were out of town a lot, and she toured with her dad a couple of times, and I think you went by herself. She went
sure.
by herself and stuff. And what I want people to realize in the 60s, because I think, I don't know if it was said on the air, but I remember Denny mentioning this about his dad. He had two phones at his house. One was their personal phone. The other was for sessions, and it always had to be answered. Because if you missed the gig, you could miss the next gig. It was that competitive, and it was that important. I mean, you know, that was their livelihood, and I know the same thing. It must have been the same way with you. But being on the road and stuff, how could you, you know, you were away from the gigs. Did it conflict? Did you lose a lot of stuff from that?
Sometimes, but most of the time we were in Las Vegas doing those big shows so that you could hop on an airplane in the morning and be back, but in the afternoon, late in the afternoon, in time to do the show. And I remember Hal Blaine and I were constantly doing that, you know, running back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Louis Shelton got hung up coming back, and he didn't know whether he was going to get back from one gig one of the times when we were at the Hilton International. And he made it just in time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that was our lives, you know. You had to do it. And then sometimes he would just say, okay, for this week I'm not going to do it. And it was almost like a vacation.
Right. But I mean, as a being one of the main players and the reputation that you had playing, you know, playing in all those sessions and stuff, the producers weren't that accommodating? Or, I mean, was it like that real? Because, I mean, some of the stuff from the way Tommy was talking about it was more like it was you had to be there.
You really did. But as far as the way I like to look at it, I wish I could say it was only me. It wasn't only me. It was myself, a kid by the name of Mike Rubini, mm-hmm. Al DeLore, Larry Knechtel, and mm-hmm. then Leon Russell mm-hmm. when he got to town. So, I mean, there were four or five of us mm-hmm. that could possibly do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we were all capable of, you know, if they wanted whatever style it was, we could come up with it. And we weren't insulted if somebody say, can you do this a little more country like Floyd Kramer, who was in Nashville? Can you make it a little more like mm-hmm. Ray Charles? We were clones. That's what we had to do. And that's why we were studio musicians, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have to... I know, like in the early in the Phil Spector stuff, there was three keyboardists, usually two or three, and you basically just walked in and played what was ever in the studio. When did you start having to bring your own keyboards in?
Oh, that didn't happen until 20 years later, really.
Oh, okay.
You know, everything was provided. They always had an electric piano there. I remember they had a harpsichord. Baldwin had an electric harpsichord that did a clavinet and a couple other things. Mm-hmm. And it was okay, but it wasn't the same as a real harpsichord, which was one of the most unusual things I ever had to do on Linda Ronstadt's Sound of a Different Drum.
Oh, that's right. And you did...
We were talking earlier about an unusual, really strange thing. I walked in, and there's this beautiful wood mm-hmm. harpsichord, the real stuff.
Wow.
And I looked at it, and I said, who's playing this? You know? And Nick Vinay said, you are. And I immediately panicked. Well, I had played it earlier when I was studying, in conservatory and in high school. I got lucky to play a harpsichord once. So I knew about it. And what had happened, Jimmy Bond was the arranger on that. And I said, well, where's my part? He said, it's there. Don't worry about it. I was waiting to have some incredible... part written out for the harpsichord, and all it said when it came time for the host for the solo was Baroque style.
Oh yeah.
So fortunately I know what they meant, otherwise I would have been up the creek. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I did. I played the rock and roll solo as if Bach would be playing it. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea that it would get so much recognition, because I'm in the intro. And then I played the solo in the middle of Sound of a Different Drum. And I got a one-album deal at Capitol because I had so many people calling about it, that they said, why don't let's do an album with them.
Yeah, that's a key part of that. I mean, the way that opens the song, it's important.
Sure.
It was an important part. Now, with the Phil Spector sessions, where there's three of you, were they basically just chord charts, or did they tell you specifically what they wanted you to play?
They were chord charts, and we came up with different ways to do those chord charts many times, or on a couple of them, somebody might play an intro, or somebody would say, well, let's do that. But generally, we were the mud in the wall of sound, you know, that mm-hmm. conglomeration of all the musicians playing the same thing, but in different positions. Leon might be at the top of the piano on this one. There was an upright with attack piano. There was a concert grand, a Steinway piano. There was an electric piano. And that's how it was. He wanted to get all those different... I remember Phil going to the guitar players, and I was astonished how well he knew how to tell a guitar player. And you put it in this position, you play it in this position. Tommy, can you put a capo on, because I want to get an open sound out of you? And he had that ability to be able to do it, whereas I didn't know what he was talking about. I knew after that.
Yeah, but he must have been a player.
Oh, yes, he was. I think... Howard Roberts had given quite a few lessons. So that was interesting. And listen to all those great... Howard was the only one that ever got bugged with him mm-hmm. and walked out on a date because he got tired of playing the same thing over and 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 over.
Well, because that's such an... The wall of sound is legendary. And the way he built the sound with all those musicians all at the same time. You got to remember, back then, it was probably two-track and then eventually four-track at the time. There wasn't all the multi-track and the Pro Tools that we have now. So they had to grab that as they got it. That's one of the reasons he had all the instruments there, the players there. But let me ask you your opinion. Okay, kind of explain the approach of using multiple pianos in terms how he utilized that. And also, if you can, multiple guitars. What was the... I mean, I can understand... I mean, listening now and recording now, I'll double parts because of the stereo. But and I know that sometimes, like in the Beach Boys stuff, one guy would play the... like a Tele or a Strat, and the other guy would play the 12 string to give it a little more, you know, tinkly sound in the background. But a lot of times, when I look at some of the pictures, especially in the Wrecking Crew movie that Denny did, they're basically playing similar guitars. So what was the purpose? What did he do to make that? I mean, what was the secret of that?
The secret was that we all became one. Mm-hmm. We all, you know, that wonderful echo chamber at Gold Star. And we were all mixed in to become a conglomeration of what he wanted. And a lot of times he didn't get what he wanted until we were very tired.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been playing like for 9 hours sometimes. You know, it's not easy.
Just on one song.
On one song, oh yeah. And then Hal would never play fills. Till when he started telling Hal, okay, you can play fills, you knew we were close to make a record.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And then Hal would start playing fills at the end of the songs. And before that, we just did it and did it and did it. And they would make changes. Some of the horn parts would change. Jack Nitzsche did mm-hmm. most of the arranging for him at that point. And it's just the way it went. That whole wall was mm-hmm. was us, you know, and that all worked. It worked in that one big room of Gold Star. And it wasn't that big a room either.
I remember it. I was fortunate to see it. And it was actually not. It had a great sound.
Oh, yeah.
I did hear the room, but it was. They had those panels with the little holes and those white.
All those wonderful panels. All those wonderful baffles. And you yeah. know what it was made out of? All of that stuff. Asbestos.
Asbestos.
We didn't know what we were breathing, and all the studios had them. You know.
And they had they built their own reverb chamber. That
sure.
was part of that sound. Yes. A lot of those older studios, their reverb chambers were the key thing to it.
Listen, one of the best rhythm guitar players was a young man by the name of Russ Titleman, who went to Fairfax High School with Phil. And Russ became one of the top producers in the country, you know, later
yeah.
on, you know. And I remember him sitting there playing rhythm and just his eyes never stopped. He was taking it mm-hmm. all in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got this.
Yeah. Now, real quick, you played with some of the most amazing guitar players in the golden era. I mean, obviously, Tommy Tedesco is one of them. But you had some of the jazz guys. Because the early, one of the things I think you mentioned in the book is that how the, you know, what led up to where the Wrecking Crew came from. And a lot of those, the early guitar players in sessions and my teacher at SC, Duke Miller, did a lot of Universal Studios soundtracks, and he actually was in the orchestra when, like, in an Abbott Costello movie or whatever.
Sure.
He was one of the guys. But they were all jazz-based. And actually, you guys, your background was jazz coming into it.
Sure.
Which is interesting because these guys became the foundation of a lot of early rock and roll, like the Beach Boys and stuff, and you guys are all jazzers.
Well, I think we were perfect for it. For the simple reason that we could read, and very seldom did we get a chance to, so that we adapted and put our own style and our own feeling and how we felt a song should go. It wasn't always three or four pianos. A lot of times it was one of us
mm-hmm.
or myself on a thing. And I used to love to look at a part when they just said, go for it, you know. And it's you playing by yourself, so that gives you a chance to express. But we were jazz players, and if it was a rock and roll date, that inflection of jazz and the rock and roll was really like fusion, very, very early.
Yeah, you were mixing
stuff.
The styles.
We were mixing it together.
Now, when you were playing with Brian Wilson, for example, you were basically playing by yourself, or was there multiple keyboards?
Well, sometimes there was two, never three. I think it might be a piano and a Hammond B3 or two pianos. Or Brian playing one and I'll play another, or Larry Nechtel or Mike Melvoy. When we did, it's funny, when we did Good Vibrations, we were doing that for 3 months.
Wow.
It took that long. And in that 3 months process, Mike Melvoin played some keyboards, Larry Knechtel played some keyboards, Brian played some, and I played quite a lot. And that whole Pet Sounds album will always be one of my favorite albums. For, you know, that's just an amazing, but that's Brian. That's the genius of Brian. He knew where everything was going. He had it in his brain. He knew where...
He wrote it all out for you, too.
No,
right? No.
Not, a lot of times you had an idea, but he also liked to let you express yourself, which was great, you know.
Yeah, so he let you play with it.
Sure.
Yeah, no.
And there's a couple of videos of Brian and I going at it, which is, you know, jokingly. And on, I think on God Only Knows, he wasn't happy with the way it was. And I said, you're not happy because you're playing it long. And he was holding the notes too long on, you know, and I said, just staccato, make them short. Bop, 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 bop. And we went back and forth, and he just looked at me and said, that's it. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, science, mad science or anything. It was just a simple how to do it, you know, lighten it up a little bit.
So when the golden years of the Wrecking Crew of the 60s, you guys were the guys of all the new stuff. You were, you know, when people, even though it wasn't known outside the industry, and you guys started getting the calls, because at that time in TV and film, it went towards the combos and went more jazz and rock and stuff in the songs. So you were getting more of the film dates at that. I mean, didn't that start growing more then, or were you doing even before that?
Not for me. A lot of the other guys did. I stayed basically doing records. I did more film stuff when I was writing my own stuff.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of the guys could switch over. I would do some film, but most of my stuff was records. And it just went on that way. A lot of guys liked the film thing better. It paid a little better. But not for us. We were getting double scale anyway.
Yeah,
so we were making a really good living at it, and we did so many dates. I remember one year, Glenn Campbell and I were sitting around talking to one another, and he said, do you believe this? I said, no, I don't. I said, but don't tell anybody.
Don't tell. Well, I think in the Wrecking Crew movie, Carol Kay says, or Tommy Tedesco, she says it to him, I'm making more money than the president. She was making more money than the president of the United States at that time. That's how much they were in demand. I mean, right. So many people wanted you guys to play on their records, and you know, it was the golden
touch. You know, and then Motown, when they came out, I was lucky enough to do a lot of those dates. I remember the first time I met James Jamerson, you know, it was great. You know, what a great musician, you know. Mm-hmm. And then some of the Funk Brothers would come out on occasion, you know, but I didn't meet them till way many, many, many years later.
Well, when you did do, let me ask you real quick, because you did do some film scores. What was the difference in terms of doing a film score and a record date? Was the record date a lot more looser? Did you have a lot more?
Much more freedom on a record date. The film, you had to do it the way they wanted it, because you're dealing with frames, mm-hmm. you're dealing with click tracks, you're dealing with in and out, you know. You're dealing with stings. You're dealing with all that, all those things, and then the worst thing you got to deal with is the director and 9 producers, and everybody's, you know, they get their $50 worth, you know.
Really? So they you would have to redo just because somebody else, there was a committee in there.
I wrote one piece of music for a film I did called Bloody Mama.
Okay.
Which was Bobby De Niro's first film with Shelley Winters.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a drowning sequence in this film that is horrifying.
Ooh.
I mean, they are trying to drown this girl in a tub who is one of the Barker gang's sons, girlfriend, and she would not die. That scene with Shelley Winters holding her under, and her jaws are just shaking, and she'd pop back up. Somebody else tried. It was 2 minutes and 22 seconds long.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so you can imagine, at one point, the music was so intense and so pressuring what was going on that you were saying to yourself, I want her to die. Get this scene over. Let's get it over. So Roger Corman is the director of this
right.
film. So when we finished the film, this is a very funny story in the book. You'll get a kick out of this. But anyway, when we finished the film, Sam Arkoff, AI, the guys at the American International Pictures, they thought it was too horrifying. And they were the worst. They had the most bloody, you know, gutsy movies all the time. They took the 2 minutes and 22-second thing and cut it down to 52 seconds.
Oh, wow.
So there's, I had it starting here and ending, you know, another mile away. But now they cut it almost to a third of what it was. And you lose that whole momentum of that thing. I mean, it's still very horrifying when you listen to it and when you see the film, but it's over. They just.
I presume they wouldn't let you redo it. If it was a Corman film, they didn't have the budget.
It. They edited it. A great music editor, too. His name was Ving Hershon. He did a load of stuff, and he was very very well acclaimed with the Academy also. But that was it was too much. And Roger Corman was already doing two other films. He had already left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he could care less. He was already, you know, that's Roger's style.
Wow.
So the music had a lot to do with the intensity of that scene?
Sure it does, you know. And then when I'll tell you, I did have a gratifying, I did a concert at the Mark Taper Forum with full orchestra. And I had a lot of celebrity friends of mine that I've known since they started, including Clint Eastwood, and Clint flipped over it. What we did is, in the program, all it said was The Drowning.
Oh.
And we left that long cue, and my God, the emotion that everybody got it. They got it the same way I wanted mm-hmm. it to happen, and people came and were talking to me and saying afterwards, I'm having a pool built. I think I'm going to have them put a fence around it while they're building it and stuff. I mean, crazy stuff like that. Because they took it for what it was. It's a drowning. They didn't know about the film, so to speak. But they just were listening to it for what it was. Very interesting.
Yeah. There was no visual. You just played the cue.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Oh, cool. That's so right. left them to their imagination.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
What was your favorite score that you did? Might as well ask that.
Well, that was one of them. A thing I did for Andy Sedaris where Tommy Tedesco had to play a bouzouki, which he did not play. He played it on a mandolin. That was one of my favorite chase cues ever mm-hmm. that I've written. That was a lot of fun to do. And
Tell us a little bit. You were talking a little bit before about Tommy. This is kind of funny.
Tommy, you know, is the master. He's the King Kong. And when we started playing it, I had written it for orchestra, and the cue has nothing to do with anything in the film except that it's a chase scene. And the director and producer was Andy Sedaris, who was Greek,
mm-hmm.
and the one of the actors, Nick Georgiotti, was also Greek. And Andy says, "Well, make it sound like Greek music. There's nothing at all Greek about this film." But he wanted the chase scene to be in Greek style music, so I did that. And it's a long chase scene, and Tommy Tedesco was hired to play bouzouki, you know, the Greek
mm-hmm.
similar to a guitar, I guess. And he says, "I'm playing it on mandolin." I said, "What do you mean you're playing it on mandolin?" He says, "Because nobody will know the difference." I said, "Yeah." He says, "Yeah, you'll know, and I'll know, but nobody else will know." And by God, we did the cue, and he wouldn't rehearse it with me. He just sat there smoking a cigarette. I rehearsed it with the orchestra twice, and then he said, "Okay." I said, "Let's make it." So we made it, and the first time he played it through, he was absolutely perfect. And of course, there were mistakes in the orchestra, so I had to do it again. He was perfect again. I mean, but he makes that whole cue. Incidentally, there was a good friend of his who came out from Buffalo. His name was Lou Morrell.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I could get those two guys together, two guitars on a date,
mm-hmm.
if there were two guitar players, it was Lou Morrell and Tommy Tedesco, and it was like putting soft butter on warm bread. I tell you, they were so good with each other. They just clicked. And Lou was a rhythm player more than where Tommy could take the lead. Lou very rarely played lead. But Tommy, those two guys together were amazing to me. And they could probably do anything, you know, especially Tommy, because that's what he did do. You know, he could do any genre that you needed. He could do it and get away with it. He may not have known it perfectly, but he could do it well enough to eventually everybody's going to say, wow, listen to that.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, a lot of the guys were like that. You know, Glenn Campbell was an amazing player. But yeah. He was not the player that Tommy was, with the sophistication that Tommy could add to it. Whereas Glenn was more of a country blues player, but his chops were unbelievable. I mean, he was amazing.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of people got when he became a singer and then he did the television show, that kind of overshadowed it. But he was always a killer player.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean.
And he in the studio, he could give you whatever he wanted, you know. There's Al Casey tells a story in a Wrecking Crew film about something stupid. There's a guitar figure at the very beginning, and the two guitar players on that record were Glenn Campbell and Al Casey.
Huh.
And Frank, it was for Frank, you know. And Frank said, no, that's not right. And Glenn was playing. He says, no, that's that. And then Al Casey looked over, he says, Glenn, I know what he wants. I played it on the composer's version that he's listening to. So Glenn said, here's the part. And he handed it to him. They switched parts, and that's Al playing that lead guitar thing, mm-hmm. not Glenn on that one, too.
Well, I remember he was, there was a thing in the Wrecking Crew where he, Wichita lineman, the lead, and he borrowed a six-string bass from Carol Kay and did the lead. And I remember, I was thinking about that. I didn't realize that that was a bass because I was like, it was a great sound.
I thought it was a Dano. No, but it was...
Dano Electro or something.
No, yeah, yeah.
But
I'm
it was
sure.
it was a bass, a six-string bass. But that's a real deep sound. And I remember trying to get that, you know, because I used to love that song. And I was trying to figure out how do you... That's really deep. My guitar doesn't sound... Why does my guitar doesn't sound that deep?
Hey, you know, you talk about Glenn Campbell. We would go in and do demos for other composers. And some of the hits that you've heard with other singers, I mean, big million-selling records, there's still a better version that nobody ever heard, and that's Glenn Campbell singing that demo.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about this a few weeks ago, and we were saying, well, where are they? Who knows where they are? They would be invaluable. But he was just such a master, and go in and learn the song in 3 minutes, because we had to do so many of them to get it, you know, nobody could afford to pay union scale on those things, so we'd help each other out, especially for composers, to get their songs to different artists and stuff like that. And Glenn, one of my favorite songs that he did was, I can't remember the title now, but it was written by Red Stegall and Donnie Lanier. Here I go again, she's back in town again, I'll be the clown again one more time.
Uh-huh.
And Glenn sang the demo of that, and I said, my God, he should release this. This is before anybody knew who Glenn Campbell was.
And, yeah, he was great.
And then, I mean, two country singers had hits with it. Ray Charles had a number one record with the same song. And then Norah Jones and Ray Charles years later did that duet on that same song. But the best version is still someplace with Glenn singing.
So did you play on his albums?
No, I didn't. I played on some of the songs he did, but that was Al DeLore playing, who was also his producer on most of those things.
Oh, okay. So that's
And that was Carol Kay.
Wow. Now, as things evolved in the 70s and 80s, and, you know, there were more tracks, obviously. By the 70s, we had 24 track by then. And... the sessions must have changed because, you know, in the early days, because you were like the, you know, with the Phil Spector, you were trying to get everything in a track or two, not even in stereo, but trying so that he would bring all those instruments in. So I would presume that the sessions started changing when you had more tracks and you would be called individually, but you would be layering stuff, right?
Yeah. And the disappointing part of that is, you don't have the camaraderie of seeing somebody sitting across from you. And you don't have the chance. So many sessions we did in the early days, somebody would make a mistake. Not truly a mistake, but a different direction. And then all of a sudden the producer said, wait a second, what did you just play?
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes the new direction for that song. That doesn't happen anymore because you're individual. You're usually putting down a track. And you're listening to maybe two other musicians that have all played on it already, but right. It's so impersonal. And I got in an argument with a young producer I made a mistake on the first chorus of the song. Just a teeny thing. You probably could hardly hear it. But we went through this. I said, could you just go back and let me fix that part? He said, no, don't worry about it. I said, it'll take you 2 seconds. Just go right back. I even took the number down and told him. He says, no, Don, don't you understand? I said, no, what don't I understand? He said, you did it right 3 other times. Cut and paste. That's what he did. And I lost that battle. It's over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But when did you start? You obviously, to survive as a keyboardist, you obviously had to start playing, you had played the Rhodes or whenever you were assigned. Yeah. But then the synthesizers came in, and you had told me he was the first Mellotron player in L.A. who played the Mellotron, which I presume you had all. You had to. Well, I'm a big I love the Moody Blues.
I hated it. it was not easy to play. I remember on a number of the dates that I did it, I remember doing a date for Jimmy Haskell and the song Having My Baby with Paul Anka.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that on a Mellotron, and your mind has to change because the tapes are moving, so that if you don't hold it down while you're going to the next patch, you can hear that sound.
You hear it.
But if you're careful enough, and you can make them blend, and it's very challenging to do.
Yeah, you had to, because when you play the note, just so everybody understands what it was the first sampler, and it had tapes in it of orchestral or choral or whatever. And when you hold the note down, there's a capstan that's running. It'll pull the tape and play it. It would last about 7 seconds. So if you held it really long, it would stop. But when you let go, the tape drops back down. There's a weight. And the trick was, if you let it go, it was an abrupt ending. So a lot of guys would play, they would, as they held one note and were getting ready to let the note go, they would start the other note, so it would kind of mix in make it smooth.
They'd layer it.
Yeah.
And make it in that chord, and that way, but it's very challenging to do, especially.
It's a different type of legato.
Yeah, sure, especially if the chords are moving. It's not like you're holding one chord for the whole song.
But I heard that because the union hated them.
And of course.
So you guys had a lock. I heard they used to lock the doors and you would do the session.
It was totally illegal, and I didn't do many times because it was outlawed, first of all. Then.
Yeah.
Then later on, all of a sudden everything became. I was the guy that went to the union and said, you have a chance to stop this now. If you do it now, it'll be over with. And they're just using it for effect. Yeah, they weren't using for effect. They were using it to replace. I remember a famous trumpet player, Connie Condoli, said, "What have you been doing?" We were joking around. He says, "Yeah, I have become a synthesizer enhancement unit."
Yeah. Well, no, it's true. I mean, even like a famous score, like not The Hobbit, but the earlier one, The Twin Towers and all of that stuff,
yeah,
The Lord of the Rings, they used samples to enhance the orchestra, make it sound that huge.
Well, Vangelis, right. I mean, when
that
room surrounding him, with 9,000 Moogs and whatever, but that's how he did it, and I think he understood it probably as well as anyone.
Well, with like the Moog synthesizer, if you were playing like a mini Moog or you were playing one of the modulars, then those sessions with the more tracks, you would have to layer and orchestrate.
Sure.
So you eventually had your own electronic keyboards that you would bring.
Yes, the first keyboard I got was, I had the Fender Rhodes, then I had my Steinway B with the Forte MIDI mod, which enabled me.
Would you cart that to the studio?
No.
Okay.
But there were some studios that did go ahead and do that, though,
mm-hmm.
Eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But I had that, and I could trigger a number of different. I had a Roland, 150, D50.
And it could
trigger those different things, and it did it really pleasantly. It wasn't. I loved the strings sounds with the acoustic piano much better.
Right.
It was just delightful, to do that. But then, you get into, I had a DX7. We were in Tokyo doing concerts, and we all brought them back because I forget what West LA Music, the guy from there said, bring back as many as you can. I'll buy them all from you.
Right.
And we did.
Well, the story, just so everybody knows, DX7 was the technology of the DX7 came from the Synclavier. And what happened was whoever was the legal guy at Synclavier forgot to renew the patent. And as soon as it went public domain, the DX7 came out. It killed them, Synclavier.
Sure, sure. Wow.
And that's why everybody wanted that, because it had that FM synthesis. And its tying sound was like to die for.
Oh, yes, it was excellent.
Because I worked at a studio called Sound Arts that was Paul Beaver's old studio.
Sure, I remember that.
Paul Beaver was one of the top Moog synthesizer guys in town, and he used a lot of Nova chords. You probably played one of those too. Harp, he had electronic harpsichord, all his instruments. He had every keyboard. But he had one of the first ones there that I remember that came in from Japan, and it was all in, the back panel was all in Japanese. But everybody wanted that tying sound. It was really clean.
Sure.
And it worked well with piano.
I remember when we brought it over, we had to bring it to the shop to have the electric change to American
the voltage.
Voltage, yeah. Because it was all Japanese, right, in the very, very beginning. And then, of course, when the other synthesizer, I loved the Oberheim 4.
Yeah, Oberheim was great.
Oh, my God, those analog sounds. I'll still put them against most of
Did you ever use the Sequential Servants Prophet 5?
No.
Because that had a fat sound
too. Yeah, it was great.
Did you ever get into samplers? Did you ever use samplers or not too much?
Not too much. I got something interesting I can tell you about a guitar. I was on a session in the very beginning, and a guy's Fender amp was giving him a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned around, and he was really, and he kicked it. That's when all the amps had tubes. And all of a sudden, there was a fuzz tone coming out of the thing. And that became the sound that the producer wanted. I think it might have been on a Marty Robbins record.
Oh, wow.
And that was the sound he wanted. He kicked the damn thing, and bzzz.
Well, the guitar sound from Davy Allen and the Arrows, that fuzz sound, they razor blade the cone of the speaker, and that's how they got that sound.
Jeez.
It's little things like that make it interesting.
But you see, that's why those dates were so interesting. Those things could happen, That they didn't happen by, you forcing it. They just happened naturally, and all of a sudden there becomes a whole new genre, a whole new way to go. I remember doing an album called Rubber Soul Jazz.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time I did Rubber Soul. I loved the Beatles, and I said, I'm going to do every song in their thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Marshall Lieb, who was one of the Teddy Bears with Phil Spector and Annette, he said, I want to produce that. He says, I think you're absolutely right, and let's do it. And he went and sold it to, I forget the label now, but it was owned by VJ Records,
mm-hmm.
Randy Wood. Mirwood was the name of the label. They had a sub-label, and we did that, and it took off. I mean, it was what I would call the first jazz rock fusion album.
Oh, wow.
Because we had all the rock feeling in it, and we had, here we are playing Beatles music. And I remember getting a review by somebody in San Francisco. You can't do that. That's not jazz, You can't play rock and roll. And a year later, everybody and their mother was recording Beatles tunes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very proud of that.
Now, you had mentioned that the Linda Ronstadt session where you played the harpsichord was one of the more unusual. Was there anything that you did where you had maybe with piano, you had a process that was really strange, or did you do something, like backwards piano or something, really weird?
I'll tell you what they did do. I had, the only hit record I ever had was a song called Mexican Pearls.
Okay.
It's a piano record with orchestra. And I forget the guy, Bruce Botnick was mm-hmm. the second on it, but there was a guy who was the first engineer on it, and I can't remember his name right now, unfortunately. But Tutti Camerata, who owned Sunset Sounds, he was the one that told me, he says, Don, I think it's time for a Latin song right now. And I'm looking at him, I said, I'm playing jazz, Tutti. He says, I know. He says, but you play all the other stuff in the studios. He says, hands me a bunch of mariachi records. I said, I hate mariachi. And he... And I said, why are you doing this to me? And I went home and I listened to him. And his final words to me were, I want anybody to be able to play this song with one finger. And I looked at him. I said, oh, my goodness, that's a producer. You know, mm-hmm. he told you everything you wanted. And I went home and I wrote this thing called Mexican Pearls. The piano sound on that record is probably one of the best piano sounds you'll ever hear. And it was the first time that they used a limiter on the piano.
Hmm. Wow.
And you could hear it. And you got, don't make a mistake, because you're in a lot of trouble with that thing. It gives you away in a heartbeat.
Right.
And it was recorded that
you way. Must have played consistently enough to keep it from,
oh, yes.
like, gating.
He used a limiter on it, and then little by little, a number of other people started to do it. His name was Ross something. He was Australian or English, mm-hmm. and I just can't remember.
That's interesting. Name. You mentioned Botnick. Botnick was famous for the, I think he did the Doors, and he also was Jerry Goldsmith's main mixer for years and years and years and years.
Also, he in the very beginning did a lot of the early Elektra stuff too. What's his name? The trilogy album, Mickey Newberry.
Oh,
Bruce
okay.
did that too. Which is a great album. And he did another, I think he was on the Tim Buckley things, too. I just don't recall for sure, but Bruce was around. His father was Norm Botnick, who mm-hmm. was one of the violinists, studio violinists,
mm-hmm.
and a great violin player, too. So it was, Bruce was very talented, though. You knew eventually he was going to go. I did all my ABC sports themes with Bruce at Sunset. Sound.
Well, Sunset Sound was a great. I mean, I was lucky to play there. I told, this was off the air. I'll tell this story real quick. I was there. I was really young, and we were doing a session there. And they, I always used to talk to the engineers. I forget who the engineer was, but they were great. As a little kid, you know, I was only like about 14 or so. They would take me in and tell me, explain stuff. So he took me in the back room, and this was in the 60s, 66, 67, or something like that. And in this, they had pulled the crate apart. It was in the back room. It looked like it, today it would look like a huge copy machine. It was huge. And it was the first 8-track in L.A. They just got it. They hadn't even wired it in.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was just, and he's like, yeah, we just got this. It's like, we're all excited about this because we got tracks. Now we can overdub and do everything in stereo. And they're like, he was all excited about it. But that was Sunset Sound, and that's
sure.
a legendary place.
Sure.
That and Gold Star.
I picked out two of those Steinways that Tootie had in those studio at Sunset Sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to two different piano companies, and they were great Steinways. The Steinway B, for some reason,
was popular. Yeah.
And of course, Keith Albright was the number one tuner. God bless him. I guess he's close to 90 now. I think this is maybe the last year he's going to keep tuning. But he would always put an edge on that, just a little bit, where if we, instead of 440. I think it might have been 442, and I think the brightness of that made it easier for an engineer to record. Just that little yeah. edge, you know. It wasn't sharp enough to really be sharp, but it just had
right.
that brightness.
But that's an art, because you can make – I've heard dark Steinways, but if you tune it right,
sure.
it can be bright. But now you mainly played Steinways in the studio. Did you ever play Baldwins?
I didn't like – Baldwins were too mild for me.
Okay.
You know,
they always seemed dark to me, but that could have been the way they tuned them.
Well, no, it was Baldwin itself was not a bright piano. Where a lot of the Bösendorfs are bright, just like the Steinways are. You know,
what about Yamahas?
Yamahas are okay in the beginning, and after about 8-10 years, they just don't feel as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. I think the wood perhaps is too new. You know.
Now, in the studio, like with the Beach Boys, when they were using the uprights or the spinets,
sure.
right?
They yeah, sometimes.
Were those Steinways?
No. They could be anything. Mm-hmm. It could be anything. You talk weird pianos, and it's still there in Studio A, I think, or B at Capitol. That old Wurlitzer electric piano.
Mm.
I played that on a ton of dates there, especially for Lou Rawls. But that piano had a special, warm, whirly sound, as they try to do with all the synthesizers now.
Speaking of the Wurlitzer, did you work with Jack Nitzsche a lot?
Sure.
Did you do the Neil Young album with him?
Yes, I did.
So you did that Wurlitzer, the
that,
whirly
at the very end,
and Laughing Lady. Well, Laughing Lady.
Yeah.
That's him.
Amazing.
History. Great. That's great him. Album. That's my him. Favorite Neil Young album. It was well produced.
But that whole blues thing at the end of that, what is it?
It swings at the end.
The arrow.
Broken Arrow.
Broken Arrow.
us.
That's Buffalo Springfield. That was on the Buffalo.
Well, it was Neil Young, but it was Buffalo Springfield.
You were doing him at the same time. Yeah, yeah.
And you know what? I kept looking in the window. When do I stop? And I kept going.
Keep going.
You know, it goes on for 2 minutes at the end of that
record.
It's
a 6-minute song, I think, or something like that. But I love Laughing Lady. That little riff that you play on that as he's singing, the mood of that whole thing is just beautiful. What was Nietzsche like? What was that? That must have been interesting.
Jack was a very close friend of mine. We grew up we lived very close by. I was in love with, he had a great wife, Gracia Nietzsche, in the very beginning. And she was one of the original Blossoms. She was the only white girl in the Blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fanita and Darlene and Jeannie King and those people were the Blossoms, but Gracia was also part of that.
Well, in those sessions, specifically with the Springfield and the Neil Young solo album, was that mostly Nietzsche that was putting that together, or did Neil really tell him what to do?
I think a lot of the arranging was Jack, but they worked well together.
Mm-hmm.
They worked very well together. In my book, I tell a story, a fishing story, about Neil Young and Jack Nietzsche.
Go ahead and tell it.
We go fishing. I had a boat. I loved boats. And I had a 25-foot, you know, fishing boat. So Jack and Neil decide we're all going fishing. We took a day off. We were in the studio for about 2 weeks in a row. So now we go, and my boat was in Marina Del Rey, so we come out to Malibu. And they said, can we drop anchor? You know, and I'm looking, and I said, why here? He said, well, out came the spyglasses. We were about a half a mile from the beach at Malibu, right?
Right.
And they're, you know, we throw our lines in and we're fishing, but they're digging the chicks on the beach and, you know, checking everybody out. And all of a sudden, Neil Young's line takes off. I mean, it is screaming, bzzz, goes straight out into the ocean. And I don't have very heavy weight. I had, I think, maybe 8-pound test line, which is means you can catch an 8-pound fish, maybe a 10-pound fish. And this was a much bigger. And it's going, and then all of a sudden it stops, and Neil's looking. And I said, start reeling. And he's reeling and reeling and reeling and reeling and coming back. And he is the color of a glass of milk. That's how white he was. and you know, he's reeling. And all of a sudden he stops, and it takes off again. Well, this went on for over an hour. And finally it got close enough to the boat, and I looked, and it's an 8.5-foot. Blue-gray shark, that one of those not nice sharks. And it's right next to the boat, and my boat is 25 feet, so if it's 8.5 feet, it's a
right.
pretty
it's a
big
third,
size.
Third of the boat.
You know,
probably an angel shark.
You know, and we're looking at it, and I don't have a gaffing pole to grab it to pull it on, and I don't want it anyway. I don't have anything. They'll knock them out with a hammer and then pull them on. And I said, Neil, he said, we got to get it. And we're reeling. And now it stops, and it's just looking up, and it just raises out of the water, and it makes eye contact with Neil, like they're like a foot away from each other, and it raises his head and snaps the line and takes off like, screw you, buddy, see ya.
Oh, man.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I one of the things that's great about this book is some of the anecdotes. And you guys were a pretty rowdy bunch. I want you to mention this one. It was one of my favorite stories is when you guys were, I forgot who you were rooming with, but you went to order, tell the whole story about you went to order steaks.
Well, you could only room with one person for this to happen. It has to be Hal Blaine.
Okay, it was Hal.
So we were on tour in 1968. At the very beginning, Hal was on this tour. We were campaigning for Hubert Humphrey when he was running for president.
Jeez.
So we're in Minneapolis, St. Paul, where they have a blue law on Sunday that there's no alcohol served right. for the day, and then all the restaurants close very early. We finished our concert, and we were coming back, and the dinner place in the hotel closed at 8 o'clock, and I think we got there, we were back by 8:30, and everybody's going to go out to White House for hamburgers, and this one's going this one. And Hal and I are rooming together, And he said, I'm starving. I said, me too. I said, he says, maybe we could call down to the kitchen. Maybe somebody's there. So I look at him. I said, they're closed. He says, no, say it's for Frank. And I look at him. I said, you've got to be kidding. He says, it's worth a shot. So I pick up the phone, and I call down to room service, and the guy answers the phone. And I said, I'm calling for Mr. Sinatra. And we got back a little late, and I understand the kitchen is closed, but you think... She said, just a second. And he gets the chef. The chef comes on. What would you like? And so we ordered a couple of New York steaks with baked potatoes and bread and everything. And me, I'm just going along with the program, not even, thinking. And then I put the order on. I look at Hal. I says, now what? He says, I got it. I got it. So the guy comes. 20 minutes later, there's a knock on the door with our food. And Hal goes in the bathroom, turns the shower on, come fly with me, fly up to the moon. He's singing, and the guy's looking, I said, and I'm pointing to the bathroom, that's the boss. He really appreciates what you did, And I said, you forgot the bread. Stupid. And the guy goes running out again, comes back with the bread. Hal's already out of the bathroom. He's got to go back in the bathroom.
Turn the shower on.
Come fly with me again. The guy rings the rolls. And then he wouldn't take any money from us. I'm trying to pay him. So, of course, we gave him a large tip. And afterwards, Hal says, we have to put our trays with the food outside the door so when everybody gets back, they'll see that we ate here and we didn't have to go out. They were so, the rest of the, it was a big band that we were taking on tour with us. Plus Nancy Sinatra's guys, which was us. And they came back, and nobody could figure out. And we didn't say anything for a year later. And then we told everybody what we had done. but we ate.
That's a great story. Anyway, we're out of time now. And I just want to thank you, Don, for being on the show. The book is called You've Heard These Hands. You can get it pretty much anywhere. I got mine at Amazon. It's a great book. There's way more stories, but he talks about everything, playing the clubs, doing the sessions, and it's just all about the golden era. It's what you have in here is just invaluable, and thank you for all the influence.
Thank you for having me here. Great with you guys.
It was a pleasure. And check out www.donrandy.com is his website. There's more information on there and all the stuff that he's doing. And when you get a chance and you're in L.A., go to the Baked Potato. That's his club. It's a great place. Sounds killer.
Oh, yeah.
And Monique, give us information on you because you're now back in town. So if you need work on... You did a great job on my Les Paul. So if you need work on amps or I know you Retolex.
Yeah, just find me on Facebook, Monique Caravello, or through Jeff here at the radio station. And
your email is momo.allaboutguitar@gmail.com.
That's right.
Okay, everybody, have a great week. We will see you we'll be back next week. Thanks again. And also give a special thanks to Karen.
I will.
I met her on Facebook this morning and she did this is a great book. Everybody, have a great night. We will see you later.